Senate Revenue Committee.
Standard of proof.
For February the 13th. Today, we are going to have a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 2. And we're also going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 61. Let's begin by asking if there's any orders of business for the committee. We've had some changes in our schedule in the ensuing couple of days, and I'll just let Mr. Warner explain those to the committee.
Would you say?
Changes to our schedule. Welcome, Mr. Representative.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, the schedule for the next couple of days will be focused on education-related bills. On Wednesday, a public hearing tomorrow on Senate Bill 519, which increases the number of expenditures that are eligible for the transportation grant. And back again with Senate Bill 260, which is the ESD funding bill. And then on Thursday, for public hearing and possible work session, you have Senate Bill 260, this bill you'll be talking about today, Senate Bill 61, and Senate Bill 519, all for public hearing and possible work session.
Thank you. Questions?
Okay. Well, the work session is on Thursday.
Yeah.
Okay. I just didn't see work session.
Okay. Let's move to Senate Joint Resolution 2. And Mr. Warner, who are you going to have make the presentation on orienting the committee?
Mr. Chair, I've assigned myself to Senate Resolution 2 to look at stabilization funds. So
into the breach, Mr. Warner.
I'll go through that with the committee.
Go.
I have in your packet kind of an outline that I use. We've had a fairly large number of stabilization fund bills over the years. And certainly one of the reasons for that is the fact that we are one of five states that does not have a formal stabilization fund. So we've had a number of proposals going back over the last three or four biennia. But really, if you look at these proposals and the outline there under stabilization fund issues, they all have to have four elements to them. The first is, and probably the most difficult in terms of passage of a stabilization fund, is they have to have revenue sources. And there has to be a way of building the fund up. And SGR 2, I'll go through those in a minute, what are proposed in that. Then there has to be triggers. And the triggers, oftentimes are economic triggers, usually something that would indicate a recession. A recession, even at the national level, does not have a formal definition. Actually, it's a group called the National Bureau of Economic Research goes back and formally dates recessions after the fact. But there are some rules of thumb that are used. At the national level, it's gross domestic product, two consecutive quarters that are declining. We don't have up-to-date information on gross state products, so usually what these measures have is non-farm payroll employment, which the Employment Department tracks on a monthly basis, and two consecutive declining quarters is usually a pretty good indicator of recession. For example, in 1991, we did have two declining quarters our last recession. In the deep recession, the early 80s, we had considerably more than two quarters. There's also typically budgetary triggers, such as a projected deficit. SGR 2 has that as one of its criteria. And there's usually political triggers requiring, for example, a supermajority. And again, SGR 2 has an element of that. The third component is some uses of the fund, the restrictions on how it can be used, or is it just a straight appropriation for the legislature. And finally, there's usually a cap of some type on the fund, so it doesn't get too excessive, and it's what would be deemed to be adequate to meet the needs in a what would be a typical recession.
That's true.
Question.
Paul, did you say we're the only state without a stabilization fund?
Senator, there are five states who don't have a formal stabilization fund. There are some states that have a stabilization fund without anything in it. So that is a little misleading, but there are 45 states do have a formal stabilization fund.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Of those, of the other states, is there a general description of their, are they primarily reliant on property tax or income tax, or is it a mixed bag in all states, sort of like here?
Senator, you know, you have the states that, you're speaking of the states that don't have a stabilization fund, or
just
45 that do?
45 that do.
Okay. Well, most of
them. They're a rule of thumb in terms of school funding.
Well, most of the states, in terms of school funding, Oregon is actually, before Measure 5, was unusual in the sense we had a very decentralized system. The centralization of school finance has made us more typical, and for example, with Washington. Where we are atypical, of course, is in our revenue system. And as we talked about earlier, the income tax receipts, so we're more dependent on the income tax than any other state is on any other single tax source.
Thank you.
We have the narrowest revenue system in that sense. And, of course, also keep in mind that the income tax is elastic, more elastic than the other revenue sources.
That was the point I was getting at, Mr. Chair.
In terms of those kind of elements, stabilization fund issues and the contents of SJR 2, in terms of revenue sources, the measure would call for 75% of tobacco revenue to go into the fund from the master settlement of 1998. If you look at the December revenue forecast, there was projected to be $328 million for calendar years 2002 through 2005. So assuming that the measure became effective on January 1 of 2002 with a November 2001 election, that would be about $246 million to go into the stabilization fund over that four-year period. Another revenue source is lottery revenue growth, and it's defined on a quarter-to-quarter basis. Given the forecast in lottery and lottery earnings, this is unlikely to be a large amount of money. Total lottery earnings are forecast to grow $8 million during the 2003-2005 biennium. So if you take 50% of that as laid out in SJR 2, that would only be $4 million. The average, another source of fund is to establish a charitable checkoff on the income tax form. And there are five participants currently, and on the 98 returns, they received about $118,000 on average each. So that would be another potential source. Interest earnings from the fund itself would be a source, and then any other donations that might go into the fund. The triggers, the measure calls for an economic recession being imminent or predicted. It doesn't define what that is, and there could be some statutory language to go with this, but it does call for a projected budget deficit during the current biennium. So, you know, you typically get you can get a shortfall, such as we've had this last budget cycle, projected for the next budget period, but this would refer to the current budget period. So it would be, you've passed a legislatively adopted budget, and then sine die, and then during the interim, the quarterly forecast comes out and says revenue is down, we're projecting deficit. So that would be a recession and a deficit are stipulated in the measure as a trigger. So those have to occur together. The other way that the fund could be tapped would be on a 3/5 vote of the both houses declaring an emergency. So that would allow the fund to be tapped. The way the wording in SGR 2 is, it would be to tap the earnings from the fund rather than the principal to make appropriations.
Question.
So, Paul, the assumption in looking at that language is that the fund would only be tapped after the start of a biennium if conditions had changed? looking at line 16 through 20 on page 3.
Mr. Chair, what that's referring to, particularly on line 19, is a negative ending balance for the general fund for the biennium for which the forecasts are being made. And I would interpret that as the 2000, you'll have an adopted budget for 0103, and then it would be for that 0103 period, not for the 0305 period. For that current.
For example, now when a lot of people, there's mixed bags, but a lot of people are predicting that we're heading into a recession. This wouldn't play until that happens after your end of the year. I mean, it's not really clear here whether this talks about forecasted and predicted, whether it talks about the legislature putting the budget together, and those things change. Like, for example, the current budget predicts a shortage of funds to continue the current service level.
Yes, I would interpret that as you have to have an adopted budget before you can have a deficit. In other words, the legislature has to pass a budget based on a revenue forecast, and then that forecast goes down, creating a deficit. So it would be a negative ending balance projected with the current, with the adopted budget. So, the governor has to balance in his recommended budget to whatever his forecast is. And the legislature would have to approve some balanced budget, and then it goes into deficit because the economic conditions deteriorate.
So if we were looking back, it's easier to look back. If we were looking back to 1983, after the legislature had went through the 81-82 biennial, where they had come in four times and cut the budget, and 83 they're looking at continuing cuts, that wouldn't qualify because you were starting the budget period. It would be the assumption is even though revenues were down and you may be in the midst of the recession, you still would bounce to that, and then tap the fund.
That would qualify, because what happened was the regular session met in 79 and then again in 81 and passed a balanced budget, and the session ended. And then after the session had ended, a new forecast would come out and say, no, this is lower than the closing session.
I'm saying in the 83 assembly, though.
Mm-hmm.
So you've come through that, you tap the fund and you're using it, but you're looking at the next biennium's budget and the economy doesn't look like it's going to get any better.
Mm-hmm.
So you would stop using them under that scenario?
Right. The fund would be used if there's a projected deficit in that current biennium. So it would be eligible to use it for that biennium. Now, if you came in the next session, and then there was a closed session forecast, no matter how low it was, but if it was balanced to that, then I would interpret that you couldn't use it under this.
Which would always be the case, because legislature always has to at least start out with a balanced budget.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is that aspect is a between sessions interim a tool. The other tool is the 3/5 majority declaring an emergency. That is an or rather than an and. So the legislature could declare an emergency, get a 3/5 vote, and then tap the fund. So in the case of a severe recession, you come back with a May 15 forecast that says it's not going to get any better, and they turn out to be right on the forecast, you would have to declare an emergency to use the fund.
So almost the first part of that thing, the present or likelihood of an economic recession, doesn't really make any difference. It's really the second one that's the motivating factor.
Yeah.
And you're really talking about you're projecting a shortfall of funds.
Because it's an and not an or.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, there is some language in there in terms of uses of fund in which the fund cannot be used to build budgets and expand programs. There's some language that education could not be cut more than other general fund items in terms of budget balancing. But other than that, it's fairly general use. The other issue is on the size. There is a 5% cap. The fund cannot be more than 5% of general fund revenue plus lottery revenue. That's the cap on the funds. Once that happens, then there's $400 going into the fund.
Mr. Chairman, so what's our total general fund budget right now, miscellaneous? Is it 12 billion roughly?
It's, yeah, the general fund is around 11. The general fund plus so-called discretionary lottery is about 12.1.
Okay, so using, if this was the law today, then well, roughly $600 million would be the fund?
Yes.
And then you could only expend the interest earned?
Yes.
Which might be $50 million, $60 million? Not much of a stabilization fund.
That would be in term. The key issue would be when you could use the fund and when it would be available. Once the fund built up, then of course you'd be generating significant amount of interest.
But if you had it full, it would be $600 million. I guess the general fund revenues increased, that pot would increase too. But you're still only at 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem like a lot of money to me.
So we can, pretty much caps at $50 million of usable money.
Well, the interest earnings, though, would accumulate over time. So you'd have interest earnings. You would have, if you had a fund that was at $500 million and you had 10% interest per year, you would have $50 million the first year, then $100 million, and so on. So that interest earnings would accumulate if you didn't use it.
So that would be added to the corpus then?
Yeah.
That would accumulate in the principal balance.
That, yeah, those earnings would accumulate, and you'd be able to use those earnings.
So, okay, but isn't there's another provision here that says when the amount of the fund exceeds 5%, that,
yeah,
if I'm understanding this correctly, can be used for other general government purposes. How does that mechanism work?
Well, that means that the fund is capped at the fund is capped at 5%. So you're putting dollars in to build the principal,
mm-hmm,
and as those dollars are going in, it's generating interest earnings.
Okay.
So the interest earnings eventually will be the biggest part of the 5%. So over time, eventually, the fund will mostly do those interest earnings.
With the excess flowing back to the general fund.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I understand that.
Trying to understand the language here. Does the amount by which the fund principal exceeds 5% of the total revenues to the general fund, including net revenues from the state lottery, shall be appropriated and credited to other funds and accounts in the state treasury to be used for general government purposes.
Right, so the excess dollars flow back into the general fund after the 5% cap is hit.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually replacing all of the corpus with earnings and then overflowing back to the general fund. Does that make any sense?
It does, but it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I understand what you're doing.
You're not going to have more than a 5%.
Just not sure that's a good stabilization fund.
Okay. Well, we can.
So you're saying that once the earnings, if you don't spend the earnings, once you get the corpus to 5%, that the other doesn't become part of the principal?
It flows through in the net.
Yeah, it's like a stabilization fund with a big hole in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, without the overage being returned to the general fund, at some point in time, all you got is stabilization funds that are triggered that you can't get to.
Most all stabilization funds will have a cap. Otherwise, they're going to absorb more and more dollars, and then the theory is that they become bigger than they need to be, and that they become tempting to use.
Right, and then I think there's two obvious purposes for having the stabilization fund, and we can bring Mr. Reeder up, and he can probably untangle the explanation that I'm about to give you. But one of them, of course, is to preserve bond rating, and the other, of course, is to have, in case there's a genuine downturn in revenue producing activity in the state of America. So the first thing to look at, as you are, colleagues, is number one, whether or not the fund is adequate, and how those components connect with the general fund, how they flow. The other is whether or not you think that the triggering mechanism is adequate. in the previous iterations of the stabilization fund that we saw in the last legislative session, I think the problem was that two-thirds of the schools in Oregon could close for lack of funding without creating the quote-unquote rainy day that would trigger the dollars to flow. On the other side of that equation, if the Portland Metropolitan Schools had a problem, that would be a rainy day, and the funds would flow. So there was a relative disequity in terms of population triggers and distress definitions. And I think that's one of the problems we ran into with the rainy day fund as an iteration of stabilization. It's a bit different approach.
Yeah. So the emperor's new clothes approach, Mr. Chair. I mean, we'd be in a depression, out of a depression, back in another one by the time this thing helped.
Yeah, that is, you know, part of the problem is it adequate? You know, that I think is Senator Minnis' question. And the other part of it is the use of the tobacco dollars as a reasonable source for funding. You know, and the idea here is that you could do this on approval of the citizenry if they had modified the Constitution with the funding factor here. So it wouldn't be a matter of waiting, and it wouldn't be a matter of having the lottery dollars build the fund up. You'd have the fund on adoption. It's a relatively quick move. Of course, the other thing is then, is the triggering mechanism the kind of thing that gives enough flexibility for the legislature, acting in special session, for instance, to come and make a three-fifths vote? Is it quick enough to respond to actual economic conditions?
Well, Mr. Chair, does this resolution have legs in this chamber?
Well, actually, I think a part of that depends on what the committee learns from Mr. Reeder. Part of it depends on Mr. Glenn's credibility in the process. Part of it depends on the leadership in both the Senate and the House.
Right.
I haven't really asked any of those folks. You know, we have the bill before us. Let's look at it on its merits. If there's technical questions we have, we should ask and pursue. In the meantime, I will take people's temperatures.
Because, Mr. Chair, I'd be looking at also trying to amend this to make it meaningful look at what a lot of people have talked about for years, which is putting a kicker component in it. I mean, the whole notion, I mean, of the rainy day fund that we've totally blown now, if we're headed towards a recession, and because of Sizemore and the Measure 5 dependency, on state income taxes, we're in a deep hole right. We could be in a deep hole right now in terms of school funding. And if you know, we didn't do anything in the good times. You know, maybe we'll do something in the bad times, but maybe we should entertain. I mean, I just want to figure out if it's worth even going to legislative council and drafting an amendment to this that would include the kicker.
Well,
it says constitutional.
Senator, I think you can refer it. I think you can try anything that works. You know, some would argue that if we added line games and used the other increment produced from the line game lottery to fund a rainy day fund, maybe even at a larger cap than 5%, we'd be doing something that would work even in recessionary times.
Right, but some would look at this as a pressure to add line games, too. I mean, from a very cynical perspective.
Right.
I mean, I would think, to be honest with folks, you know, because whether line games goes or not shouldn't be the question, you know, which kind of gambling.
No, I'm simply suggesting there may be other alternatives, and
yeah.
I think maybe Senator Miss may be pursuing another alternative. The point is, in any discussion we've had with folks from the bond managers or the portfolio managers here in the state of Oregon, with the folks from the Secretary of State's office and the state's treasurer's office, basically they've said Oregon needs a stabilization fund to preserve interest rates on our bond. That price, I think, is more than enough premise for us to look at something like this. So let's just go ahead and look at the merits of the bill and see what else we might be able to add to the strategy. Matter of fact, why don't we bring Mr. Reeder up there to try to add some clarity to the need for this. We are in public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 2.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli, members of the committee. My name is Brian Reeder. I'm a financial analyst with the Department of Education. I'd like to keep my comments fairly brief, and I suspect we may have a lot of questions. I'm here today primarily to express the department's support for the concept of a budget stabilization fund. This particular fund is aimed primarily at education, but in general, the department favors the notion of a stabilization fund for state government in general, and primarily for the two reasons that Senator Farioli mentioned, the first being maintaining Oregon's bond rating, which allows us to borrow at lower interest rates, and the second, which I think, at least in my mind, is the more important, and that is allowing for more even funding when we are facing a revenue shortfall due primarily to an economic slowdown or even a recession. As I'm sure most of you know, over the past 10 years, we've had a very robust economy in the United States and in Oregon. Income tax revenue has been growing quite rapidly. At the same time, we've cut our property taxes fairly dramatically. The result has been that our total revenue picture is not nearly as rosy as it is in many other states. Many of those states do have stabilization funds, and over the last 10 years, they have had the opportunity to place significant amounts of revenue in those funds if they chose to do so. We haven't had that option here in Oregon. We now find ourselves in what I would consider a fairly precarious position, and that is we're facing the possibility and I think the stark reality of not being able to fund services at the level they were at 2 years ago, despite our robust economic growth, and are currently looking at the end of our growth as we've known it for the past 10 years and possibly looking at a recession in the next couple of years. This type of fund would allow us to smooth out our spending over the business cycle and would also allow us to maintain our bond rating and reduce our borrowing costs. With that, I'll stop the comments that I had prepared and maybe address a couple of the questions that had come up. In terms of how quickly the fund balance accumulates and whether 5% is sufficient, the language in the bill is a little bit ambiguous about what part of the fund represents principal and what part represents earnings. My interpretation is that we keep those two pots of money separate so that the 5% applies only to the principal of the account and that earnings never turn into principal. They continue to accumulate, and those are the monies that can be spent so that the balance available for spending over time can exceed the 5% and represent a substantial amount of money that those interest earnings don't replace other funds that are considered principal in the fund. There are, clearly you could set up the fund differently than that, and there we may need to have some discussions about how we really intend to do that. I would agree with Senator Corcoran and Senator Minnis that a total of 5% of the general fund budget doesn't look like a lot of money when you're facing some serious shortfalls. But if you're defining interest and principal as separate pots of money, that interest portion or the earnings portion may be much larger as it accumulates over time. Now, clearly, in the situation we're facing now, we're not going to have a lot of accumulation of that in the short run, but the department's feeling is that we need to start by putting this stabilization fund in place and start putting money into it. It may be small amounts initially, but this is a long-term endeavor, and we need to start now.
Question, Senator Minnis?
Well, if I'm reading this correctly, I mean, once you get to the 5%, the monies that are the interest earned just flows into other accounts, it doesn't define which accounts in the treasury to be used for government purposes, to that, that tells me that the money's going to be expended every biennium. But it seems to me that a better financial principle would be to have two accounts, if I'm following what you're trying to do, have the 5%, have another account that's set up that is the interest earned, and rather than have it just automatically flow back into other accounts, make that total pot subjected to the 3/5 vote, so that it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger over time. So to me, that seems more of a better financial long-term strategy, knowing how legislatures generally function. If the money's available, we're gonna take it, we're gonna use it, whatever. I mean, the idea, if I'm understanding stabilization, is we want long-term stability, we want the ability to assure that we have resources available for it, for public education and general government purposes, but knowing the kind of the personality and nature of legislatures, I'm not sure that this really gets us there.
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Minnis. As I said, I think the language here is ambiguous. If we do what I, the way I had interpreted this initially was any interest earnings never turn into principal, so they would not be subject to being paid back to other programs. It only principal in excess of 5% would flow out of the fund to pay for other programs. The interest earnings would always be separate from the principal balance and would not flow back for other programs. Only principal in excess of 5% would flow back.
Okay. Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
I think
you
that was a key clarification.
Well, and I honestly don't know what Superintendent Bunn intended with this language. My interpretation, which seemed quite clear to me at the time, was that those two pots of money are separate and it was only principal that is limited to 5%, and the two funds never mix.
Mr. Vice Chair.
So is the assumption then, Brian, that we're building for long term, and I sort of see the two funds separate then, is that the one goal is to build a corpus equal to 5% that will, as it's growing, is going to kick off earnings into a separate fund, that we would never then use the corpus?
Mm-hmm. Chair Ferrioli, Senator Beyer, that's my understanding, is that it would represent a permanent fund whose purpose was to generate earnings, which could then be expended.
Okay. So then to call it the earnings fund is what would be there for the proverbial rainy day, and would we cap that at some level?
Senator Beyer, I think that you can cap that, although this bill doesn't do that under the interpretation that I'm putting forth here, is that there is a cap only on the principal portion, not on the earnings portion. And if we manage to go for another long stretch of robust economic growth like we just went through, it's possible that that earnings fund could get quite large. And currently, in this language, there is no cap on how large it could be.
If you look at traditional cycles, which we just came outside of 1 year, isn't about a 7-year cycle?
That's a fairly long. Chair Ferrioli, Senator Beyer, that's correct. This is quite an unusual period that we've just come out of, or that we appear to be coming out of.
So the concept would be that we would probably, once established, I'm thinking once we had the at it there, we would probably be dipping into it every 5 to 7 years to cover the gaps, the low points in the economic cycle.
Now, Senator Beyer, I think that's probably a safe assumption that we're not going to go for very long periods without having met some of the triggers that would allow dipping into the fund. And even if we didn't meet the economic triggers that the option of declaring an emergency would still be there for the legislature if it was felt that even in times that weren't considered a recession or that didn't officially meet the definition of a budget shortfall, for example, if we predicted very low revenue and therefore had a budget that was quite low, but still felt that we would like to put more money in state services, that with a three-fifths vote, that would be possible.
Is there any forecast on how long it would take to build the fund up to a usable level?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Beyer, I haven't done that. I mean, it depends a great deal on how much gets put in, the timing of adding principal in the early years, and which represents the base on which you earn interest or you have earnings. As you know, we've spent the tobacco money three or four times already, spending it a fifth time. What harm can that do? So there's a real question about how much and how quickly we can afford to put principal in the account, and that will drive how much the earnings are.
So the suggestion, Mr. Reeder, is that we take all that tobacco money and buy lottery tickets. Colleagues, let me explain. This bill, I believe, has a particular purpose, and that is it's aimed at school stabilization. There are, and as such, I think it does some things that may not be features of other approaches that we've seen in the building, the ones that we've seen in previous sessions and others. I think there are several pieces out there that we need to have, but I'm glad that we've got this bill introduced for public hearing, that the members will have an opportunity to take it back and think about strategic changes that they might want to see included in this approach. But Mr. Warner, what can you tell us about some of the other approaches that are out there, and what's the prognosis for those bills being surveyed side by side with this bill by this committee?
Mr. Chair, I know of four of them out there, and there may be others. There is one currently in the House Revenue Committee, House Bill 2299, which is proposed by the governor. I have a corresponding House Joint Resolution, HJR 5. The biggest difference, and there are a number of similarities with this one, as there are with a number of these. The biggest difference there is that it would use the 15% that's dedicated to the Education Endowment Fund, 15% of lottery revenue, and use that to build the principal, whereas this is mostly dependent on the tobacco settlement revenue. And there are some other differences as well, but it's trying to get at the same issue of how do you, the revenue system is income tax dependent, but the difference now from 10 years ago is that schools are much more dependent on that source than they were in the past. The other ones that I know of, the Treasury has one that was introduced and was in the House Government Committee. That measure basically doesn't specify revenue sources, but it tries to establish the fund formally. So it's really to begin the process of having something in the statute, in the statutes that would be there and available for appropriations and other revenue sources. There's also another one that's pretty similar, really, as a base to Initiative Measure 89 that was really House Bill 2007 last session, which was the Health Security Fund, setting aside all of the tobacco settlement principle and then using that as the fund as that accumulates over time.
As a stabilization.
Yes. And using the principle as the
brilliant thing.
As the fund. So
I was on that committee.
those are the ones that I know of, and there may be some others.
Yeah. Senator.
Mr. Chair, it strikes me that Mr. Warner, with his sort of crib sheet that he's got here, has really got us thinking in the right direction. And frankly, it doesn't make any difference which bill. I mean, this number is just as good to use to something else. I mean, it really doesn't make any difference which bills are out there. It strikes me that what we really need to do, and it's more the framework of discussion, is talk first when it would be available, sort of a triggers question. And as I was thinking about it, it really strikes me that you have, if you're thinking about only the whoops factor. In other words, it's 1981, the legislature went home, patted themselves on the back on a great budget, and then the economy went in the dumpster. That's one size that you're dealing with. The other one would be where we're at right now, where we're looking at a budget that we can't sustain, and we probably are looking at a mild recession or at least a flat period of growth. It's unclear which period of times we're looking at. Looking at that then, sort of the triggers model, what is it that you're trying to do? That will suggest the size. If you're looking at the 1981 scenario, you're probably looking at a much smaller fund. Because you just, all we're talking about doing then is filling the formula. It's how do we get the amount of the 5.2 billion taken care of or as much as we can, which is a different number than if you're sitting here and we're talking about trying to grow the school funding base, and getting to that discussion of adequacy or lack of adequacy. So that's the size. And I think that technically gets at sort of the two bucket approach of do you grow the corpus and then do you dip into it at some point, or do you only use the earnings and some structure, which I don't believe this building gets at very well. Going through that, that should suggest to us a number that we have to, and then we can talk about the reality of what revenue sources are available to deal with that, and there are lots of them that are out there. It's a choice of whether to use them or not, and how long it takes to grow that. I think one of the realities is the slow approach here is that we're not going to get anything out of this in the near future. You're talking about a legislature that's probably dealing with two recessions out before they'll ever be able to touch it. So it's a long growth period, and that probably means that this assembly, maybe in the next 2 years or another one, might have to be back at the table in emergency session talking about that terrible addition to or add-on to a surcharge on income tax or something else.
Well, the point I think to make is about the crib sheet's a good one. Perhaps I'll ask the staff to make copies and distribute those to all the members, because I believe that there's a number of reasons for us to look at stabilization funding. Whether or not we're actually trying to call a stabilization fund a glide path when really all it does is extend a cliff, that's one of the questions we have to answer. The purposes to which we put these dollars is another question. Are we doing it to bolster the bond rating? Are we doing it for dual purposes? Are there other considerations to be made? And I think that there are. This is an idea that seems to come back, at least it has in the last three legislative sessions. But what we need to do, I think, is understand that there's good arguments for a stabilization fund, that it could have a beneficial effect to school funding and bond rating, that those principles are clearly what's at the heart of these stabilization funds, and that we have at least five different approaches that are currently in the building. Let's take this issue under advisement, study the bill that we have before us that's been brought by Mr. Budd, look at the crib sheet that Mr. Warner's brought, because I think it does capture the elements. Understand that there are a variety of funding sources that we just probably have to take them away from somebody to use them in this program, because they've been spent five or six times, as Mr. Reeder pointed out accurately. And I think what we'll do is just go ahead and close the public hearing on this issue, but understand this will come back to the committee probably with four different approaches in addition to this one.
It's true.
Senator.
Could we get a heads up from you when you're thinking about bringing it back so
yes.
we can bring all of our ideas?
Yes. Actually, I'll talk to the House Revenue Chair and ask him what his plans are for hearing these bills in his committee. And I'll talk to the legislative leadership and ask them if there's an approach they favor that might have legs, as the good senator from Cottage Grove asked earlier. I don't know. And then we'll bring them all back to this committee, and you'll get plenty of advance warning.
Mr. Senator, could we ask the staff to do some projection work on what would it take to build a fund and how long, the kind of levels and numbers that we might be talking about?
And actually, could we start on, let's send some of the staff on a theoretical exercise. Let's look at the four or five approaches that are out there and do a side-by-side comparison about when and what.
Aren't the approaches mainly...
Because I think they're going to have to do that anyway.
Mr. Chair, aren't the approaches mainly... The differences, I've heard them, the differences mainly in how you put money in the fund. not on what it should be and what the size and so forth.
Okay. If you could, Mr. Warner, give us a survey of what's out there, and then show us in the perfect world of the economist where there are never two opinions. Just show us what a fund must look like to be effective. I see Senator Minister is biting his knuckle, and Senator Church has a question. Senator Minister, did you?
Well, I've got some questions about this, but I guess we can bring those back at a later time. But I'll just kind of lay this out. If I understand this bill, monies that are donated or gifts are also capped, you know, and they would flow into debt. So I'm wondering about why we're doing that. For instance, if we're actually going out and seeking corporate contributions to the stabilization fund, why not have a provision that would allow the corporation to designate that as part of the principal balance so that it's kind of like a perpetual gift?
Right, and that way they are fully endowing. They would be, that would be an endowment gift rather than just a gift by way of three trickle-down theories into the general.
Because I think once you get that point where you've got to reach that 5%, there's no incentive for gifts because it flows into the general fund of the state.
Trickle-down theory? Did I hear trickle-down theory?
I didn't say it.
I said yes.
I know better than to set you off.
Senator George, you have the luxury of the last word on
that. All right, that comment may be close to my question, and that is, this may be a very small trickle, because if you think about going back over the last three biennium budgets, we've been adding $400 to $500 million K through 12. Now, if you think about right now, we're at 5.2, we came from 4.8. I would like to also, as we extend those numbers out, actually build in a projected increase in K through 12, and then show us what the percentage of that budget that this might represent. Because to me, I look at the math, and it's less than 1%. 1% is a real small drop in a bucket.
In point of fact, we might just be extending the cliff a few inches.
Mr. Chair, one thing we do know, and it was Senator George's point, is that the tobacco settlement revenue, which is the largest piece here, it will not grow very fast. I mean, it's going to be about $75 million a year. There's some downward risk there because it's dependent on volume of shipments. So in other words, if smoking goes down, then that revenue clearly over time will not grow as fast as income in the general fund budget.
And Senator Griffin mentioned the possibility of a little cynicism there. We are spending money for tobacco cessation programs. Same time we're suggesting to increase the dependency on the support education. So there are some questions about adequacy. So we ought to deal with that. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SJR 2, and we'll go to an orientation on Senate Bill 61.
Steve. Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 61 deals with the definition of extended ADMW. As you recall from the orientation, ADMW itself is just weighted ADM, weighted for various factors of groups of students. What extended does is to compare ADMW in different years. Currently, the statute says that extended ADMW is the higher of the current year ADMW or the prior year ADMW, so a two-year time period to look at which is the highest. The bill would change the definition of extended ADMW so that you are comparing the current year ADMW to ADMW in one of the prior 4 years. As drafted, the bill implies that you add the ADMW together for those 4 years. That certainly wasn't the intent. And I have an amendment draft that would make it so that you are comparing the current year to the highest year within that 4 year period. So it would be one of those four, the highest year would be the one in that 4 year period that you're comparing the current year to. So that's basically what the bill is proposing. What I have prepared for you on the table looks at other options within that 4 year prior year time frame.
What I've done is gone back and looked at ADMW from 1997-98 through 2001-2 estimates, and have made a change in the early years to take out the IEP waiver weight, because we don't have that information for the last 2 years. So to make the 5 year period comparable data, I have taken out the waiver weights in the early years. Other than that, then the data you have here is comparing 2 years extended, the 2 year period being the current year and the prior year or current law, and then extending an additional year for that comparison period back to a total of 5 years, the current year and the prior 4 years. So the 5 years extended represents the bill as intended. But what it shows here, if you look at the state line for a moment, you'll see that under current law, the extended ADMW would total about $643,000 for the state. If you go back 3 years, it grows to $647,000, 4 years, $651,000, 5 years, up to $654,000. Now, what that process does, if you choose any one of those, is to take and reduce the dollar amount per extended ADMW for the district, assuming that the total dollars available statewide remain the same. So as that extended ADMW grows, depending upon the period of time included, then the dollar amount per extended ADMW would decline. Now, to look at individual districts, what I have done is to put the measure of extended ADMW here in terms of the student count under that column, and then the percent is what that student count represents as a percent of the state total. So what's important here isn't whether that district's extended ADMW always increases or not, but it's how does it compare to the state total or to every other district. It's a relative change that's important.
So what's important is you want to look at the percentage column?
Yes.
The impact on this.
Right. If you want to find out for a particular district which extended period gives them the highest percent of the state total in terms of student count as well then as dollars, you would look at the percent column.
Mr. Chair?
Question.
Well, wouldn't it be obvious that that would be the five-year extended because of the growth in ADMW over that period of time? Or is that not consistent?
Well, let's look at a couple districts as an example and see how that works.
Oh, no, I guess
Hillsboro, the fastest growing district.
Right. Hillsboro is the one I was going to show as the first example. And if you go across there, you see that their highest count is the current year, but in the 2 year extended period of being 22,120, if you go back across, you find that that number does not change. Right? The weighted ADMW does not change. Now look at the percent. Under the 2 years, they start out at 3.43%. As you go back, their number doesn't increase, and their percentage of the total drops because the state total is increasing. So the further back you go, the worse off Hillsborough is in terms of their total of the share, their share of the total.
Mr. Chair,
question.
But doesn't the bill propose to allow the highest of any of those 5 years?
Yes, it does. And for Portland, that's the current year.
And for Hillsborough, that's current.
Excuse me, for Hillsborough, it's current.
Right, okay. And that's the point you're making,
yes,
is that some schools may want to take the five, some want to take the current.
Right.
That's the range.
That's the range.
Okay.
Now, Multnomah, or excuse me, Portland, if you look, turn to page five.
What county would that be?
Oh, just. If you look at the percentages as you go across the page, it 2 to 3, it increases a little bit. 4, it increases a little bit more. But if you go to 5, it decreases.
from the four-year percent. And so they would be probably best off using current year and the prior 3 years, total of 4 years. Because it all depends upon when their decline starts and how it compares to the other districts in each year. So this was just to, so that you could look at your own districts of interest and see how they compare relative to the state total over that time period. Another option would be, rather than choosing any particular period of years, would be to average these numbers over whatever number of years you chose, and use a rolling average where you drop the old year and add in a new year. That would probably bring a little bit more stability over time in this process.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Question, Senator Mins?
I'm a neophyte at all with this stuff. I'm trying to figure out why this is relevant to anything. You know, we have a set, for instance, appropriation of dollars for basic school support.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure out how all these percentages and the choice of the highest year, how does that all play?
Okay, well, let's back up a minute and talk about what problem this bill is meant to address.
Yeah.
Let me just use an example. In Hefner, as an example, the school district there is looking at a pretty precipitous decline in enrollment as a result of the closure of Pioneer Resources Mill there. Mm-hmm. About 100 families were displaced. About 100 children were lost in their school district. Mm-hmm. And because there's a formula that allows the carry forward of the population losses into the next biennium or into the next school year, let me correct myself, into the next school year, they will reach a point in the middle of next year where their ADMW reflects the decrease, 100 students. Now, those schools can't consolidate classrooms because, as Senator Perkin has pointed out many times, population leaves a community, they don't all leave from the fourth grade. You know, you can't consolidate two classes and make up the difference. You've got this erosion from across the school enrollment, and the problem is that the costs are fixed and continuing, but the ADMW formula of distribution goes down with the students. And right now, we put that cliff out about a year and a half. This bill basically extends more or less either extends the cliff until the community may have a chance to recover economically, or creates more of a glide path rather than a cliff. And what we were hoping is that we could smooth out this rapid descent. They tell me that the Army has discovered that it's not the descent, it's the rapid deceleration that kills you. So, you know, the problem is that these school districts have a rapid deceleration after about a year and a half. This extends the possibility for up to 5 years. There are other approaches. I've heard 3, 4, 5 years.
Flip it around, Mr. Chairman. Fast-growing district.
This bill doesn't deal with a fast-growing district.
Well, in a sense, it does, because there's a set number of dollars available. So if I'm understanding correctly, this you know, kind of keeps you farther away from that cliff. It allows more money to flow to the declining school district and allow them to make adjustments, but at the same time, for fast-growing school districts, the available resources are likewise impacted.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then there's something we need to think about. This is a rolling five-year average. You know, the point is that you're in a five-year period. You're going to look at the highest enrollment that you have, and then you're going to ask for an ADM adjustment based on your highest enrollment and those four that bracket. And obviously, do you have to use the current year as a part of the rolling?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got a bracket around your current year of 5 years, and it can slide. If you've got precipitous declines, obviously, you're going to ultimately, as you pass that five-year, you're going to ramp down no matter what happens. If you've got a significant increase in population, yes, there is a connection, but your ADMW, you're not going to have an ADMW, a loss in that case. You know, this bill is essentially aimed at stopping the losses, or at least extending that period
when they can, when school districts can claim students that are not currently enrolled.
And for the fast-growing districts, they can pick, I guess, an earlier year that would reflect their increase?
Well, they pick a current year.
The problem is still the same.
Because they're fast-growing. Right. But the question is, when do districts get the money? That's the issue. And the issue, I believe, is they get the money if there's a decline in enrollment in this bill. This does not deal with the issue of rapidly growing enrollments.
Oh, it does, because they could use the current year or the average of some period in the past.
To calculate.
Not if they're growing. They wouldn't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the current year is the projected growth.
Yeah, but yes.
We project that. I mean, that's a given. You know, that's a projected number.
We'll put it this way. This will protect a fast-growing district if they have a serious decline or a new school opens that moves population out of their district.
Out of the district.
Yeah. Question?
Comment, I guess. For the fast-growing district, they're better off using their current year ADMW.
Good stuff.
By going back more years when other districts had a higher ADMW, you are adding total ADMW to the state total, driving down the dollars per weighted student, so that, in effect, you are shifting a little bit of money by going back earlier years. When the ADMW was higher.
Right. Yeah, what we're basically...
Getting the soup a little bit.
Basically what we're saying is that some of the communities have been in decline, precipitous decline recently, but have been in steady decline over time.
Yeah.
This tries to help them. Let's completely switch gears here a little bit and look at a completely different approach to what this bill does. In terms of dollars, the bill puts essentially more dollars into those schools that have eroded in terms of population. And the question is, how many more dollars? So I think that, you know, we have to look at the ADMW times $4,500 to figure out what the net effect is to schools. And my understanding is that the range of transfer could be up to $40 million total. But perhaps you could walk people through, how do the dollars actually change and how does that affect? We're moving dollars around within the $5.2 billion number, but what are the real dollar effects of change that we've made here?
Mr. Chair, I have not converted these percents here into dollars yet. In terms of, at the $643 million, we're still at what was on the original run.
Mm-hmm.
No change to that. And then as you go back to the five-year extended, would be the same total dollars divided by the $654,000. I did not do that to see how much of a dollar drop that is for a weighted ADMW.
Okay. But I think the effect I'm after is this. Right now we have about an 18-month period where we extend the ADMW. By moving that to a three-year period, we're essentially increasing the overall distributions to those schools that have dropped income or dropped ADMW.
Correct.
And that has a cost. And that's the dollar amount that I'm looking at.
It's a shift.
Right.
And so you could compare how much the districts that are using their current year lose and how much the district that is gaining by going back years, their dollar gain. But the amount for weighted ADMW would remain the same for each of those districts.
But we're essentially allowing people to count more as students.
Yes.
Right. And so that it has a revenue impact on the school.
Yes.
And that's what I'm asking.
So these are the average student numbers, Steve. I'm looking at Portland, for example, and I'm trying to get in my head. My understanding is Portland is losing students.
Correct.
And if you were looking at the gross numbers, the ADMW extended, this implies it's going up, but that's because you're averaging over those periods of time?
No, these numbers are not averages. They're a comparison of 1 year to another year.
Okay, so just let me be real simplistic about it. If you look at the first column, it says 59,000 ADMW. If you look at the last column, it says 60,000.
Right.
So this is looking back. It says there were 60,000 and now there's 59.
Yes.
Is that what we're looking at?
Yes.
So that indicates the decline.
I did, Mr. Chair.
Question.
I just tried to do the simple math here for Portland, figuring out their best and worst, and I can't quite figure out if I got all my zeros lined up, but it looks like it might be like about $78,000 difference in a 9.175% of the share versus a 9.217% of the share. And that's a huge school district, obviously. I think one of the points of this is that it's more than that.
I would.
Did I miss it by a?
I'm not sure, but I would think that it would be more than that for Portland.
Okay. Well, if it was, then it would be $780,000.
Or $7 million.
So no, I don't think it would be that. But I think the point of this is that even moving to the five, in some respects, the point of this is even moving to the 5 years, the change is on a $5.2 billion budget. It's not a massive shift of money. In most cases.
No, it isn't a massive shift of money. What it does, though, is shifts money specifically to those schools that have suffered a precipitous downturn in population, and basically allows them to count those kids at their highest population level and get essentially stabilization of programs while they restructure. And so, you know, the two hopes, I think, for stabilization during restructuring. It allows people to make more strategic choices about how they make their cuts, because they're going to have to do that. But it also gives the community a time to rebuild the infrastructure of their economy. And a 4 or 5 year period is a much more reasonable time for an economic turnaround. If you look at some of the stuff that's happened, for instance, when Burns had the precipitous decline and the loss of Snow Mountain Pine Limited. It took them about 3 years to get that site converted to manufacturing housing and mobile homes or coaches. And, you know, this kind of a formula could have helped them avoid some precipitous trauma in the schools there by stabilizing the ADNW.
Well, but I guess my point, Mr. Chair, and that's absolutely, I mean, I think that's what is appealing with this bill, but to the soup thinning question, when you look at the rapidly going, the Hillsboroughs, I think this sort of harkens back to this discussion of the $29 million in the formula or out of the formula on the federal forest receipts, because as we manipulate this, the balloon blows up somewhere else. We've got to do something about the high growth districts, and then we still aren't addressing, as we tried, I tried with Mr. Myers, who's run several runs to address this issue of how you really deal with those communities that suffered versus the school districts in those communities that have no correlation size-wise. And, you know, the benefits of this kind of plan, I think, federal forest receipt debate aside, is that it's really a small school district with declining enrollment that really gets killed and really needs assistance.
Yeah, I don't think there's a question that there's a concomitant part of the equation that isn't here.
Yeah.
That's what do we do about rapidly increasing school districts? Where they have as much population stress from growth as we would have anywhere else from declines. That is not this bill.
I guess to get to your point, Mr. Chair, in terms of easing it down, I was just roughing out from Ridge School District in Lane County, which over that five-year period lost 268 students. And the number at 5,000 students, they would gain about $1.3 million, which would be a big number in their budget. It's probably one that makes a little more difference than the $70 million in Portland's.
In which, that was in the Lane County example?
Lane County, Fern Ridge. They lost 268 students.
Right, so
translates into about $1.3 million in additional revenue that they would get.
Right, and in real terms, that would be
that's a lot of money for them.
Maintaining programs.
I understand that.
Yeah, the acres ADMW goes down a
lot. But I'm not going to drop it to $28 or $18.
Tough enough for me.
I can't do the math.
Right. So the question, I guess, for the committee is really the point in the bill explanation for Senate Bill 61 that made sense to me was that districts that have declining enrollments, either steadily declining enrollments or precipitously declining enrollments, would receive a higher distribution, one that was based on their historical ADMW numbers rather than the recent lower number. And then that does have a corresponding depressing effect on the ADMW statewide, but it sure does focus resources where the needs apparently are greatest. Questions?
I mean, I think you make a good point, but I'm concerned about going in and sort of piecemealing the formula this way. And we talked about doing small school adjustments and climbing school. And I think if we're going to tamper with the formula, we need to open the can and do it all at once.
Well, two unfortunate references back to back. Opening the can of worms and tampering with the formula.
That's what it is, Mr. Chair. I mean, I've been doing this for 5 sessions.
Let me suggest to you that we have scheduled a public hearing today only so that we can essentially start exposing the committee to these concepts, and then at some point in time we are going to look at the whole formula, the whole suite of options that we have to make selections from.
Children as a can of worms is a bit uncomfortable, Mr. Chair.
Just get used to it. Okay, anyway, the point is that one of the things that has found quite a bit of favor, at least in concept, is extending that ADMW ramp period. And then this is one that offers a sliding scale, which is kind of a unique concept. I noticed that people just lined up to testify in Senate Bill 361. That record show no one has...
Mr. Marquis always has something bright to say. Why don't we call him up and have him...
I'm not sure that would be fair. But let's go ahead and just ask the committee to take a look at this concept and know that there are other concepts that we'll be talking about that would adjust the formula. This is one that extends the ramp a little bit. And as I looked at these things, is this perhaps this would be helpful. The first column should be labeled
current
year.
Yeah.
And then you could look at 2000 to 2001 and 2001-2002 on the first column. And that may help you get grounded in where those extended years by column would take you.
Mr. Chair, I think the difficulty in this is that this is a regressive analysis and doesn't anticipate, obviously can't anticipate what changes are going to happen either in the fast growth or the slow growth.
But the point is, in context, we have to have a piece, I think we have to have a piece to help stabilize communities that have had rapidly declining. We also will be pulled into the discussion, which is a fair question. What about helping those schools that have rapidly increasing enrollment?
Do we get, Mr. Chair, any help like from PSU or from the census in terms of making those projections into the future? Question one. And question two, did we get those in 90, for instance, and did it help? Were the projections of school growth of the number of children in the school system anywhere close to accurate?
We have not used PSU to assist in that, and I don't know that any school districts do or not.
Because they were charging for parking, so we just
We used the state forecast population projection by age to assist in coming up with the statewide total.
And Senator Kirkham, your question, I think,
and that's pretty accurate.
Fairly.
But it can't. It's not a very good predictive tool out very far, is it?
Well, not when you include the weights.
Right.
It's just an ADM measure.
Okay.
And I think the state economist models the projections by commercial and residential realtors and a whole bunch of other indicators give you kind of an idea. I think we can expect the trend of growth to follow job creation.
Well, yes and no, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think everybody could have anticipated in 1990 the growth in the Tri-County area, but I'm not sure that they could have predicted, Grants Pass versus Medford, could have predicted Bend versus other parts. I don't think Bend had such a tight correlation in increased jobs, for instance. That was sort of a place, the destination. But anyway, I think you're right overall, population is affected by jobs.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, I think you could look at the federal forest policies.
Yep.
And extrapolate that there was going to be some dislocations in rural communities that were heavily timber dependent.
Or have those dislocations already taken place, which is the big question in a lot of people's minds, is even if we were to up the cut level starting next year, you know, that infrastructure's gone. All those gypo loggers are gone. You know, the big guys, I'm sure, could come in, but the gypos are all gone.
Well,
of course,
there's a lot of folks on the east side that are still waiting for the change, and they're just hanging on. I hope there is a change.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions for the committee, Senator Jones?
Are we to diagram all the different bills? Because I know the Backlund Winters bill that I worked under in the interim is similar to this. It's, there's some that are program protection oriented. They're doing using the same kind of formula. Can we put all these bills side by side, kind of compare?
I actually think that would be a good request for the committee. I think staff deserves to know. You know, we've been trying to do a preview of coming attractions for the committee. Maybe we need to widen the scope and look at what's in currency in the building and figure out what might be coming over. You know, when you set them side by side, there's good concepts in each one. And, you know, the product hopefully will do the most good for the most people when we finish with it. Questions?
The Senate President has been talking about these futures committees, several. I think there's one on transportation, there's one on education. I can't remember what the other one is. But I'm just wondering, given, you know, and we've had discussion in our caucus about even the makeup of the committees and whether certain parts of the state are represented on revenue committees.
Or possibly over-represented.
Blah, 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 or possibly over-represented. So I hope all the money comes to Lane County. But I wonder if it wouldn't make sense to have, like, you know, one person from each caucus have some, you know, from each chamber have some sort of meeting to analyze the bills that are out there that anticipate changes in the funding formula, because otherwise, you know, you could see a big train wreck with the House looking one way, Senate looking another, and we'll be here till July.
That's when we normally end.
So you're running the pool, is that the...
Yeah, so I'm running the pool, that's right.
That's right.
No, I think
trying to up the lottery for some joint resolution, too.
Well, I think the point you make is very accurate and well made. The idea is that my intention as the committee chair is to make sure that the committee gets the survey of what's out there, and then, you know, Senate revenue is going to have the responsibility of dealing with all the revenue bills and formula bills, and you know, the idea that we would have them all dumped on the table at once would simply be overwhelming. So the chair's approach has been bring them forward, let's talk about them, put them into context with the other bills that are in the building that we will get, and then at some point in time, the committee's going to be asked essentially to come to the meeting with an idea of what concept we want to move forward and what approach is appropriate. So, sir?
At some point, when we get into this discussion about the formula, I would like to have a serious discussion about attendance, because I think attendance is important.
At the committee meetings?
Yours.
And like whether or not we can put a stop to that.
But I do think, I think it's a relevant question, at least I think it is, it may not be, but you have rural school districts that are declining and they're trying to preserve resources. My assumption is that a lot of those folks show up for class. In the Portland school districts, and probably in Park Rose and some others, I think there are some attendance problems, particularly in certain schools. I wouldn't want to, I guess, add a component to the formula that would immediately take resources away. But I would like to have a discussion about how relevant attendance is, and maybe in districts where they're not paying attention to getting the kids to show up for class, that there be some ratcheting down over time. Where they're not doing a good job of having kids actually show up for class. Now, I know that's kind of a complex discussion because there's an assumption about how many kids on any given day might not be there because of sicknesses and so on and so forth, and then whatever is done would have to take that into account. But I think if you have a population where only 60% of the kids ever show up at any given time, I think that's the biggest problem. And if we can address that in the formula, well, maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't, I don't know, but at least I'd like to have...
And this, I think there is some work on that. There's some stuff in the benchmarks, And I think there is just as large a challenge in attendance in rural schools.
Is it?
I think so. But, you know, bears looking at. And certainly if there was a way for us, as long as we're going to spend all this money on education, we will get what we want. And if what we want is higher levels of attendance, then we should put incentives in the programs. Senator Byron and Senator Clifton. And then Senator George gets the last word. So let's go to Senator Byer, Senator Corcoran, and then Senator...
You know, I sort of make the assumptions when we're doing the formula up front based on the statewide projection of how many students are going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual allocations of dollars kind of goes back to the reports, I guess, and it's going to go back up how many kids were actually there, signed up in the school district, and... I wondered if we'd ever track that to see how close we are from where we started to where we ended up with the auditor reports in the end. I know one of the issues that always pops up is we see the runs and assume, you know, it's going to be 48-12 or something for ADNW and pass that off and have these discussions with our local school boards, and then they discover that, oops, there are more kids in the system than the suit got thinned. And I've never actually seen any tracking of how close we were to those numbers.
I have not tracked that either. What's slightly different this session is that we have made a statewide projection of what we think the total should be, in terms of weighted students. What you see, the numbers that you see for the districts is what they have reported to the Department of Education as what their estimate is.
Okay. So this is their estimate?
This is their estimate. Now, what has happened is that the sum of the district estimates don't add up to what we think the statewide total will be.
So which number do we use to budget?
Well, so who's the dang?
So if you go...
The last guy to ask that question is floating in a 55-gallon drum somewhere.
So they're estimating a lower number than...
What we think the statewide total will be. Right?
So the school districts are counting noses and giving a number. And the state's doing an estimation, and the estimation's higher than the NASA.
The district should be doing an estimate, too. So what I have done, and probably haven't noticed in simulation one, is at the end, there's county Z with two reserve amounts in it, one for the IEP waivers that will be added above 11%.
Can we form a DSD for County Z?
As long as it's not in Eastern Oregon.
And the second component is a reserve for a low ADM count.
I just remember 1983 setting there trying to figure out Portland, and the representative from the district was projecting one number, and Ozzy Rose said, and I says, don't believe that, they're wrong.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, I just think that Senator Menace should declare a conflict of interest because of his interest in being a supervisor of truant officers as he retires in the sunset. So I just wanted to put that on the table. I don't want to cause any friction between a good senator and
you may
good.
Put that on the table along with your half-eaten donut that you brought in yesterday.
It wasn't half-eaten. It was just half a donut.
To defend my colleague's report, Brian, is it possible, do the district's report to the Department of Education actual daily counts, in other words, attendance? No. Is that a number we can even achieve? They don't. I see one head going no and one head going yes.
For the record, Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Chair Ferrioli, Senator George. They do. The problem we face in planning for the coming year is that the ADM and the weights that districts report to us are estimates that they've developed. And our position has been that they're in a much better position to make those projections than we are here in Salem, because we have 198 school districts and conditions vary tremendously around the state. The problem we have is that districts have an incentive to give us a low projection. And the reason is that if they project too high and budget for that, and then actuals are lower, they have a budget problem.
Right.
They've got less money than they thought they were going to have, and so they tend to forecast low so that they don't create this budget problem for themselves. But that creates a problem for us, and that is the sum of what they report we think is quite a bit lower than what the statewide total is going to be, and that's why why Steve has created District Z and the department has created what we call the dummy district. And it is a district...
That's the one...
Fill my lip.
I didn't know we had a little Italy here.
Dummy high, huh? I'm going to leave now, Mr. Chair. What's the matter with you? I want you, what's the matter with you?
I graduated from there, and high school is five of the best years of my life.
That's right.
It's hard to
Senator George, thank you for asking your question. Oh, yeah. I don't know if it got an answer, but the idea is that the population is obviously an arcane science, and there are reasons for underreporting, and so we shouldn't, I don't know if we should get too twisted over the exactitude of that number, but notwithstanding, attendance is a key element of education. You got to go and get educated.
Well, I think it's helpful to have these kind of discussions, because if you do have built into what we're doing, an incentive to underreport, I mean, maybe the question is, should we do something about that, or is there anything we can do about it? What do we care?
But the state economist had to do the same thing on the, that's why the darn kicker kicks all the time, because if they go too high, that's right, though, you said this, you testified about this, if they go too high, then we have a budget problem.
I think it's time to quit.
Thank you.